Recorded Books presents an unabridged recording of Map of Bones by James Rollins, narrated by L.J. Ganser and directed by T.G. Reynolds. This book is copyrighted 2005 by Jim Tchaikovsky. This recording is copyrighted 2005 by Recorded Books. The author opens with the following quote from The History of the Holy Roman Empire, published in 1845. The holy relics were granted to Reinald von Dassel, Archbishop of Cologne, following Emperor Barbarossa's sacking of the city of Milan. Such a treasure was granted to the German archbishop for his aid and chancellorship in service to the current emperor. Not all were content to see such a treasure leave Italy, not without a struggle. And now, Map of Bones.
Prologue. March, 1162. The archbishop's men fled into the shadows of the lower valley. Behind them, atop the winter pass, horses screamed, arrow bit, and cleaved. Men shouted, cried, and roared. The clash of steel rang as silvery as a chapel's bells. But it was not God's work being done here. The rear guard must hold. Friar Joachim clutched the reins of his horse as his mount slid on its haunches down the steep slope. The loaded wagon had reached the bottom of the valley safely. But true escape still lay another league away, if only they could reach it. With his hands clenched on the reins, Joachim urged his stumbling mare down to the valley's bottom. He splashed across an icy brook and risked a glance behind him. Though spring beckoned, winter still ruled the heights. The peaks shone brilliantly in the setting sun. Snow reflected the light, while a billow of rime frost flagged off the peak's razored tips. But here in the shadowed gorges, snowmelt had turned the forest floor into a muddy bog. The horses slogged up to their fetlocks and threatened to break a bone with every step. Ahead, the wagon was mired just shy of its axles. Joachim kicked his mare to join the soldiers at the wagon. Another team of horses had been hitched to the front. Men pushed from behind. They must reach the trail coursing along the next ridgeline. "Hey-ya!" yelled the wagon master, snapping a whip. The lead horse threw its head back and then heaved against the yoke. Nothing happened. Chains strained, horses chuffed white into the cold air, and men swore most foully. Slowly, too slowly, the wagon dragged free of the mud with the sucking sound of an open chest wound. But it was moving again at last. Each delay had cost blood. The dying wailed from the pass behind them. The rear guard must hold a little longer. The wagon continued climbing again. The three large stone sarcophagi in the open wagon bed slid against the ropes that lashed them in place. If any should break... Friar Joachim reached the foundering wagon. His fellow brother, Franz, moved his horse closer. "The trail ahead scouts clear. The relics cannot be taken back to Rome. We must reach the German border." Franz nodded, understanding. The relics were no longer safe upon Italian soil, not with the true pope exiled to France and the false pope residing in Rome. The wagon climbed more quickly now, finding firmer footing with each step. Still, it trundled no faster than a man could walk. Joachim continued watching the far ridge, staring over his mount's rump. The sounds of battle had settled to groans and sobbing, echoing eerily across the valley. The ring of swords had died completely, signaling the defeat of the rear guard. Joachim searched, but heavy shadows steeped the heights. The bower of black pines hid all. Then Joachim spotted a flash of silver. A lone figure appeared, limned in a patch of sunlight, armor glinting. Joachim did not need to see the red dragon's sigil painted on the man's chest plate to recognize the Black Pope's lieutenant. The profane Saracen had taken the Christian name Fierabras after one of Charlemagne's paladins. He stood a full head taller than all his men, a true giant. More Christian blood stained his hands than any other man's. But, baptized this past year, the Saracen now stood beside Cardinal Octavius, the Black Pope, who took the name Victor IV. Fiera Bras stood in the patch of sunlight, making no attempt to chase. The Saracen knew he was too late. The wagon crested the ridge at last and reached the rutted, dry trail atop it. They would make good speed now. German soil lay only a league from here. The Saracen's ambush had failed. Movement drew Joachim's attention. Fiera Bras drew a great bow from over a shoulder, black as the shadows. He slowly set arrow to string, notched it, and then leaned back and drew a full pull. Joachim frowned. What did he hope to win with one feathered bolt? The bow sprang, and the arrow flew, arching over the valley, lost for a moment in the sunlight above the ridgeline. Joachim searched the skies, tense. Then, as silent as a diving falcon, the arrow struck, shattering into the centermost casket. Impossibly, the sarcophagus's lid cracked with the sound of a thunderbolt. Ropes broke free as the crate split, scattering open. Loosed now, all three crates slid toward the open rear of the wagon. Men ran forward, attempting to stop the stone sarcophagi from crashing to the ground. Hands reached. The wagon was halted. Still, one of the crates tilted too far. It toppled and crushed a soldier beneath, breaking leg and pelvis. The poor man's scream christened the air. Franz hurried, dropping from his saddle. He joined the men in attempting to lift the stone crate off the soldier, and more importantly, back into the wagon. The sarcophagus was lifted, the man dragged free, but the crate was too heavy to raise to the wagon's height.
"Ropes!" Franz yelled. "We need ropes!"
One of the bearers slipped. The sarcophagus fell again on its side. Its stone lid fell open. The sound of hoofbeats rose behind them, on the trail, coming fast. Joachim turned, knowing what he'd find. Horses, lathered and shining in the sun, bore down on them. Though a quarter league off, it was plain all the riders were dressed in black. More of the Saracen's men. It was a second ambush. Joachim merely sat his horse. There would be no escape. Franz gasped, not at their predicament, but at the contents of the spilled sarcophagus, or rather, the lack thereof.
"Empty!" the young friar exclaimed. "It's empty!"
Shock drove Franz back to his feet. He climbed atop the wagon's bed and stared into the crate shattered by the Saracen's arrow.
"Nothing again," Franz said, falling to his knees. "The relics! What ruin is this?"
The young friar found Joachim's eyes and read the lack of surprise.
"You knew."
Joachim stared back at the rushing horses. Their caravan had all been a ruse, a ploy to draw off the Black Pope's men. The true courier had left a day ahead, with a mule team, bearing the true relics wrapped in rough-spun cloth and hidden inside a hay bundle. Joachim turned to stare across the vale at Fiera Bras. The Saracen might have his blood this day, but the Black Pope would never have the relics. Never. Present day, July 22nd, 11:46 p.m., Cologne, Germany. As midnight approached, Jason passed his iPod to Mandy.
"Listen, it's Godsmack's new single. It's not even released in the States yet. How cool is that?"
The reaction was less than Jason hoped. Mandy shrugged, expressionless, but she still took the proffered earphones. She brushed back the pink-dyed tips of her black hair and settled the phones to her ears. The movement opened her jacket enough to reveal the press of her apple-sized breasts against her black Pixies T-shirt. Jason stared.
"I don't hear anything," Mandy said with a tired sigh, arching an eyebrow at him.
"Oh." Jason turned his attention back to his iPod and pressed play. He leaned back on his hands. The two were seated on a thin grass sward that framed the open pedestrian plaza called the Domvorplatz. It surrounded the massive Gothic cathedral, the Kölner Dom. Perched on Cathedral Hill, it commanded a view over the entire city. Jason gazed up the length of the twin spires, decorated with stone figures, carved in tiers of marble reliefs that ranged from the religious to the arcane. Now, lit up at night, it held an eerie sense of something ancient risen from deep underground, something not of this world. Listening to the music leaking from the iPod, Jason watched Mandy. Both were on summer holiday from Boston College, backpacking through Germany and Austria. They were traveling with two other friends, Brenda and Carl, but the other two were more interested in the local pubs than attending tonight's midnight mass. Mandy, though, had been raised Roman Catholic. Midnight masses at the cathedral were limited to a few select holidays, each attended by the Archbishop of Cologne himself, like tonight's Feast of the Three Kings. Mandy had not wanted to miss it. And while Jason was Protestant, he had agreed to accompany her. As they waited for the approach of midnight, Mandy's head bopped slightly to the music. Jason liked the way her bangs swept back and forth, the way her lower lip pouted out as she concentrated on the music. Suddenly, he felt a touch on his hand. Mandy had shifted her arm closer, brushing her hand atop his. Her eyes, though, remained fixed on the cathedral. Jason held his breath. For the past 10 days, the two had found themselves thrown together more and more often. Before the trip, they had been no more than acquaintances. Mandy had been Brenda's best friend since high school, and Carl was Jason's roommate. Their two respective friends, new lovers, hadn't wanted to travel alone, in case their budding relationship soured while traveling. It hadn't. So Jason and Mandy often ended up sightseeing alone. Not that Jason minded. He had been studying art history back at college. Mandy was majoring in European studies. Here, their dry academic textbooks were given flesh and girth, weight and substance. Sharing a similar thrill of discovery, the two found each other easy traveling companions. Jason kept his own eyes averted from her touch, but he did move one finger closer to hers. Had the night just gotten a tad brighter? Unfortunately, the song ended too soon. Mandy sat straighter, pulling away her hand to remove the earphones. "We should be getting inside," she whispered, and nodded toward the line of people flowing through the open door of the cathedral. She stood up and buttoned her jacket, a conservative black suit coat, over her flamboyant T-shirt. Jason joined her as she smoothed her ankle-length skirt and combed the pink tips of her hair behind her ears. In a breath, she transformed from a slightly punk college student into a staid Catholic schoolgirl. Jason gaped at the sudden transformation. In black jeans and a light jacket, he felt suddenly underdressed to attend a religious service. "You look fine," Mandy said, seeming to read his worry. "Thanks," he mumbled. They gathered their things, threw their empty Coke cans into a nearby trash can, and crossed the paved Domvorplatz. "Guten Abend," a black-frocked deacon greeted them at the door. "Willkommen." "Danke," Mandy mumbled as they climbed the stairs. Ahead, candlelight flowed through the cathedral's open doorway, flickering down the stone steps. It enhanced the feeling of age and ancientness. Earlier in the day, while taking a cathedral tour, Jason had learned that the cathedral's cornerstone had been laid back in the 13th century. It was hard to fathom such a breadth of time. Bathed in candlelight, Jason reached the massive carved doors and followed Mandy into the front foyer. She dabbed holy water from a basin and made the sign of the cross. Jason felt suddenly awkward, acutely aware that this was not his faith. He was an interloper, a trespasser. He feared a misstep, embarrassing himself, and in turn, Mandy. "Follow me," Mandy said. "I want to get a good seat, but not too close." Jason stepped after her. As he entered the church proper, awe quickly overwhelmed unease. Though he had already been inside and learned much about the history and art of the structure, he was again struck by the simple majesty of the space. The long central nave stretched 400 feet ahead of him, bisected by a 300-foot transept forming a cross with the altar at the center. Yet it was not the length and breadth of the cathedral that captured his attention, but its impossible height. His eyes were drawn up and up, guided by pointed archways, long columns, and the vaulted roof. 1,000 candles trailed thin spirals of smoke, sailing heavenward, flickering off the walls, redolent with incense. Mandy led him toward the altar. Ahead, the transept areas to either side of the altar had been roped off, but there were plenty of empty seats in the central nave. "How about here?" she said, stopping midway up the aisle. She offered a small smile, half thanks, half shyness. He nodded, struck dumb by her plain beauty, a Madonna in black. Mandy took his hand and pulled Jason down to the end of the pew by the wall. He settled to his seat, glad for the relative privacy. Mandy kept her hand in his. He felt the heat of her palm. The night certainly was brightening. Finally, a bell sounded and a choir began to sing. The mass was beginning. Jason took his cues from Mandy, standing, kneeling, and sitting in an elaborate ballet of faith. He followed none of it, but found himself intrigued, becoming lost in the pageantry. The robed priests swinging smoking globes of incense, the processional that accompanied the arrival of the archbishop with his tall mitre hat and gold-trimmed vestments, the songs sung by both choir and parishioners, the lighting of the feast candles. And everywhere the art became as much a part of the ceremony as the participants. A wooden sculpture of Mary and baby Jesus, called the Milan Madonna, glowed with age and grace. And across the way, a marble statue of St. Christopher bore a small child in his arms with a beatific smile. And overlooking all were the massive Bavarian stained glass windows, dark now, but still resplendent with reflected candlelight, creating jewels out of ordinary glass. But no piece of art was more spectacular than the golden sarcophagus behind the altar, locked inside glass and metal. While only the size of a large trunk and constructed in the shape of a miniature church, the reliquary was the centerpiece of the cathedral, the reason for the construction of such a massive house of worship, the focal point of faith and art. It protected the church's most holy relics. Constructed of solid gold, the reliquary had been forged before the cathedral had even broken ground. Designed by Nicholas of Verdun in the 13th century, the sarcophagus was considered to be the best example of medieval gold work in existence. As Jason continued his study, the service wound slowly toward the end of the Mass, marked by bells and prayers. At last, it came time for communion, the breaking of the Eucharistic bread. Parishioners slowly filed from their pews, traveling up the aisles to accept the body and blood of Jesus Christ. When her time came, Mandy rose along with the others in her pew, slipping her hand from his. "I'll be right back," she whispered. Jason watched his pew empty, and the slow procession continued toward the altar. Anxious for Mandy's return, he rose to stretch his legs. He used the moment to study the statuary that flanked a confessional booth. Now standing, he also regretted that third can of Coke he had consumed. He glanced back toward the cathedral's vestibule. There was a public restroom outside the nave. Glancing longingly back there, Jason was the first to spot a group of monks entering the rear of the cathedral, filing through all the back doors. Though in full-length black robes, hooded and belted at the waist, something immediately struck Jason as odd. They moved too quickly, with an assured military precision, slipping into shadows. Was this some final bit of pageantry? A glance around the cathedral revealed more cloaked figures at other doors, even beyond the roped transept beside the altar. While keeping their heads bowed piously down, they also seemed to be standing guard. What was going on? He spotted Mandy near the altar. She was just accepting her communion. There were only a handful of parishioners behind her. "Body and blood of Christ," Jason could almost lip-read. "Amen," he answered himself. The communion finished. The last parishioners returned to their seats, including Mandy. Jason waved her into the pew, then sat next to her. "What's with all the monks?" he asked, leaning forward. She had knelt down with her head bowed. Her only answer was a shushing sound. He sat back. Most of the parishioners were also kneeling, heads bowed. Only a few, like Jason, those who had not taken communion, remained seated. Ahead, the priest finished tidying up, while the elderly archbishop sat atop his raised dais, chin to chest, half dozing. The mystery and pageantry had died to embers in Jason's heart. Maybe it was just the pressure of his bladder, but all he wanted to do was get out of here. He even reached to Mandy's elbow, ready to urge her to leave. Motion ahead stopped him. The monks on either side of the altar pulled weapons from beneath folds of cloth. Gunmetal shone with oil in the candlelight. Snub-nosed Uzis mounted with long black silencers. A chatter of gunfire, no louder than a chain-smoker's staccato cough, spat across the altar. Heads rose along the pews. Behind the altar, the priest, garbed in white, danced with the impacts. It appeared as if he were being pelted with paintballs, crimson paintballs. He fell atop the altar, spilling the chalice of wine, along with his own blood. After a stunned silence, cries rose from the parishioners. People sprang up. The elderly archbishop stumbled from his dais, drawing to his feet in horror. The sudden motion knocked his mitre hat to the floor. Monks swept up the aisles, from the rear and the sides. Orders were shouted and barked in German, French, and English.
"Bleiben Sie in Ihren Sitzen! Ne bouge pas!"
The voices were muffled, the faces beneath the hoods obscured by half-masks of black silk, but the raised weapons punctuated their orders.
"Stay seated or die!"
Mandy sat back with Jason. Her hand reached for his. He clutched her fingers and glanced around, unable to blink. All the doors were closed, guarded. What was going on? From the pack of armed monks near the main entrance, a figure appeared, dressed like the others, only taller, seeming to rise as if called forth. His cloak was more like a cape. Clearly some leader, he carried no weapon as he strode boldly down the central aisle of the nave. He met the archbishop at the altar. A heated argument ensued. It took Jason a moment to realize they were speaking in Latin. The archbishop suddenly fell back in horror. The leader stepped aside. Two men came forward. Guns blazed. The aim was not murder. They fired upon the faceplate that sealed the golden reliquary. Glass etched and pocked, but held. Bulletproof.
"Thieves," Jason mumbled. This was all an elaborate robbery.
The archbishop seemed to draw strength from the stubbornness of the glass, standing taller. The leader of the monks held out his hand, speaking still in Latin. The archbishop shook his head.
"Lassen Sie dann das Blut Ihre Schafe, Ihre Hände beflecken," the man said, speaking German now.
"Let your sheep's blood be upon your hands." The leader waved another two monks to the front. They flanked the sealed vault and lifted large metal discs to either side of the casement. The effect was instantaneous. The weakened bulletproof glass exploded outward, as if shoved by some unseen wind. In the flickering candlelight, the sarcophagus shimmered. Jason felt a sudden pressure, an internal popping of his ears, as if the walls of the cathedral had suddenly pushed inward, squashing all. The pressure deafened his ears. His vision squeezed. He turned to Mandy. Her hand was still clasped tightly to his, but her neck was arched back, her mouth stretched open.
"Mandy?"
From the corner of his eye, he saw other parishioners fixed in the same racked poses. Mandy's hand began to tremble in his, vibrating like a speaker's tweeter. Tears ran down her face, turning bloody as he watched. She did not breathe. Her body then jerked and stiffened, knocking his hand free, but not before he felt the bite of an electrical shock arc from her fingertips to his. He stood up, too horrified to sit. A thin trail of smoke rose from Mandy's open mouth.
Her eyes were rolled back to white, but already they were smoldering black at the corners. Dead. Jason, muted by terror, searched the cathedral. The same was happening everywhere. Only a few were unscathed. A pair of young children, pinned between their parents, cried and wailed. Jason recognized the unaffected, those who had not partaken of the communion bread, like him. He fell back into the shadows by the wall. His motion had gone momentarily unnoticed. His back found a door, one unguarded by the monks, not a true door. Jason pulled it open enough to slip inside the confessional booth. He fell to his knees, crouching down, hugging himself. Prayers came to his lips. Then, just as suddenly, it ended. He felt it in his head. A pop, a release of pressure, the walls of the cathedral sighing back. He was crying. Tears ran cold over his cheeks. He risked peeking out a hole in the confessional door. Jason stared, finding a clear view of the nave and the altar. The air reeked of burnt hair. Cries and wails still echoed, but now the chorus came from only a handful of throats, those still living. One figure from his ragged garb, apparently a homeless man, stumbled out of the pew and ran down a side aisle. Before taking 10 steps, he was shot in the back of the head. One shot. His body sprawled. Oh, God. Oh, God. Biting back sobs, Jason kept his eyes focused toward the altar. 4 monks lifted the golden sarcophagus from its shattered case. The slain priest's body was kicked from the altar and replaced by the reliquary. The leader slipped a large cloth sack from beneath his cloak. The monks opened the reliquary's lid and upended the contents into the bag. Once empty, the priceless sarcophagus was toppled to the floor and abandoned with a crash. The leader shouldered his burden and headed back down the central aisle with the stolen relics. The archbishop called to him, again in Latin. It sounded like a curse. The only response was a wave of the man's arm. Another of the monks stepped behind the archbishop and raised a pistol to the back of the man's head. Jason slunk down, wanting to see no more. He closed his eyes. Other shots rang out across the cathedral. Sporadic. Cries suddenly silenced. Death stalked the cathedral as the monks slaughtered the few remaining survivors. Jason kept his eyes closed and prayed. A moment before, he had spotted the coat of arms upon the leader's surcoat. The man's black cloak had parted as he'd lifted his arm, revealing a crimson sigil beneath, a coiled dragon, the tail wrapped around its own neck. The symbol was unknown to Jason, but it had an exotic feel to it, more Persian than European. Beyond the confessional door, the cathedral had grown stone silent. The tread of booted footsteps approached his hiding place. Jason squeezed his eyes tighter, against the horror, against the impossibility, against the sacrilege. All for a sack of bones. And though the cathedral had been built around those bones, and countless kings had bowed before them, even this very mass was a feast to those long-dead men, the feast of the 3 kings, one question rose foremost in Jason's mind. Why? Images of the 3 kings were found throughout the cathedral, done in stone, glass, and gold. In one panel, the wise men led camels across a desert, guided by the Star of Bethlehem. In another, the adoration of the Christ child was depicted, showing kneeling figures offering of the gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh. But Jason closed his mind to all of this. All he could picture was Mandy's last smile, her soft touch. All gone. The boots stopped outside his door. He silently cried for an answer to all this bloodshed. Why? Why steal the bones of the Magi? Day 1. Chapter 1. Behind the Eight Ball. July 24th, 4:34 a.m., Frederick, Maryland. The saboteur had arrived. Grayson Pierce edged his motorcycle between the dark buildings that made up the heart of Fort Detrick. He kept the bike idling.
Its electric engine purred no louder than a refrigerator's motor. The black gloves he wore matched the bike's paint, a nickel-phosphorus compound called NPL Super Black. It absorbed more visible light, making ordinary black seem positively shiny. His cloth bodysuit and rigid helmet were equally shaded. Hunched over the bike, he neared the end of the alley. A courtyard opened ahead, a dark chasm framed by the brick-and-mortar buildings that composed the National Cancer Institute, an adjunct to USAMRID, the U.S. Army Medical Research Institute of Infectious Diseases. Here, the country's war on bioterrorism was waged across 60,000 square feet of maximum containment labs. Gray cut the engine but stayed seated. His left knee rested against the satchel. It held the $70,000. He remained in the alley, avoiding the open courtyard. He preferred the dark. The moon had long set and the sun would not rise for another 22 minutes. Even the stars remained clouded by the shredding tail of last night's summer storm. Would his ruse hold? He sub-vocalized into his throat mic. "Mule to Eagle, I've reached the rendezvous. Proceeding on foot." "Roger that. We've got you on satellite." Gray resisted the urge to look up and wave. He hated to be watched, scrutinized. But the deal here was too big. He did manage to gain a concession to take the meeting alone. His contact was skittish. It had taken 6 months to groom this contact, brokering connections in Libya and the Sudan. It hadn't been easy. Money did not buy much trust, especially in this business. He reached down to the satchel and shouldered the money bag. Wary, he walked his bike over to a shadowed alcove, parked it, and hooked a leg over the seat. He crossed down the alley. There were few eyes awake at this hour, and most of those were only electronic. All of his identification had passed inspection at the old farm gate, the service entrance to the base. And now he had to trust that his subterfuge held out long enough to evade electronic surveillance. He glanced to the glowing dial on his Breitling diver's watch. 4:45. The meeting was set for 15 minutes from now. So much depended on his success here. Gray reached his destination, Building 470. It was deserted at this hour, due for demolition next month. Poorly secured, the building was perfect for the rendezvous. Yet the choice of venue was also oddly ironic. In the 60s, spores of anthrax had been brewed inside the building, in giant vats and tanks, fermenting strains of bacterial death, until the toxic brewery had been decommissioned back in 1971. Since then, the building had been left fallow, becoming a giant storage closet for the National Cancer Institute. But once again, the business of anthrax would be conducted under this roof. He glanced up. The windows were all dark. He was to meet the seller on the fourth floor. Reaching the side door, he swiped the lock with an electronic key card supplied by his contact at the base. He carried the second half of the man's payment over his shoulder, having wired the first half a month before. Gray also bore a foot-long plastic carbonized dagger in a concealed wrist sheath, his only weapon. He couldn't risk bringing anything else through the security gate. Gray closed the door and crossed to the stairwell on the right. The only light on the stairs came from the red exit sign. He reached to his motorcycle helmet and toggled on the night vision mode. The world brightened in tones of green and silver. He mounted the stairs and climbed quickly to the fourth floor. At the top, he pushed through the landing's door. He had no idea where he was supposed to meet his contact, only that he was to await the man's signal. He paused for a breath at the door, surveying the space before him. He didn't like it. The stairwell opened at the corner of the building. One corridor stretched straight ahead, the other ran to the left. Frosted glass office doors lined the inner walls. Windows slitted the other. He proceeded directly ahead at a slow pace, alert for any sign of movement. A flood of light swept through one of the windows, washing over him. Dazzled through his night vision, he rolled against one wall, back into darkness. Had he been spotted?
The sweep of light pierced the other windows, one after the other, passing down the hall ahead of him. Leaning out, he peered through one of the windows. It faced the wide courtyard that fronted the building. Across the way, he watched a Humvee trundle slowly down the street. Its searchlights swept through the courtyard. A patrol. Would the attention spook his contact? Cursing silently, Gray waited for the truck to finish its round. The patrol vanished momentarily, crossing behind a hulking structure that rose from the middle of the courtyard below. It looked like some rusting spaceship, but was in fact a million-liter steel containment sphere, 3 stories tall, mounted on 12 pedestal legs. Ladders and scaffolding surrounded the structure as it underwent a renovation, an attempt to return it to its former glory when it was a Cold War research facility. Even the steel catwalk that had once circumnavigated the globe's equator had been replaced. Gray knew the giant globe's nickname at the base. The Eight Ball. A humorless smile creased his lips as he realized his unlucky position. Trapped behind the Eight Ball. The patrol finally reappeared beyond the structure, slowly crossed the front of the courtyard, and rolled away. Satisfied, Gray continued to the end of the corridor. A set of swinging double doors blocked the passage, but their narrow windows revealed a larger room beyond. He spotted a few tall, slender metal and glass tanks, one of the old labs, windowless and dark. His approach must have been noted. A new light flared inside, incandescent, bright enough to require Gray to flick off his night vision, a flashlight. It blinked 3 times. A signal. He stepped to the door and used a toe to push open one of the swinging sides. He slid through the narrow opening. "Over here," a voice said calmly. It was the first time Gray had heard his contact's voice. Prior to this moment, it had always been electronically muffled, a paranoid level of anonymity. It was a woman's voice. The revelation piqued his wariness. He didn't like surprises. He followed through a maze of tables with chairs stacked on top. She sat at one of the tables. Its other chairs were still stacked atop it, except for one, on the opposite side of the table. It shifted as she kicked one of the legs. "Sit." Gray had expected to find a nervous scientist, someone out for an extra paycheck. Treason for hire was becoming more and more commonplace among the top research facilities. Usamrid was no exception, only 1,000-fold more deadly. Each vial for sale had the capability, if properly aerosolized in a subway or bus station, to kill thousands. And she was selling 15 of them. He settled into his seat, placing the satchel of money on the table. The woman was Asian. No. Eurasian. Her eyes were more open, her skin deeply tanned to a handsome bronze. She wore a black turtlenecked bodysuit, not unlike the one he wore, hugging a slim, lithe frame. A silver pendant dangled from her neck, bright against her suit, bearing a tiny, curled dragon charm. Gray studied her. The dragon lady's features, rather than taut and wary like his own, appeared bored. Of course, the 9mm Sig Sauer pointed at his chest and equipped with a silencer might be the source of her confidence, but it was her next words that truly iced his blood. "Good evening, Commander Pierce." He was startled to hear his name. If she knew that. He was already moving, and already too late. The gun fired at near point-blank range. The impact kicked his body backward, taking the chair with him. He landed on his back, tangled in the chair legs. Pain flattened his chest, making it impossible to breathe. He tasted blood on his tongue. Betrayed. She stepped around the table and leaned over his sprawled form, gun still pointing, taking no chances. The silver dragon pendant dangled and flashed brightly. "I suspect you're recording all this through your helmet, Commander Pierce. Perhaps even transmitting to Washington, to Sigma, You won't mind if I borrow a little airtime, will you? He was in no position to object. The woman leaned closer over him. In the next 10 minutes, the Guild will shut down all of Fort Dietrich, contaminate the entire base with anthrax, payback for Sigma's interference with our operation in Oman. But I owe your director, Painter Crow, something more, something personal. This is for my sister in the field, Cassandra Sanchez. The gun shifted to his faceplate. Blood for blood. She pulled the trigger. A.M., Washington, D.C. 42 miles away, the satellite feed went dead. Where's his backup? Painter Crow kept his voice firm, biting back a litany of curses. Panic would not serve them. Still 10 minutes out. Can you reestablish the link? The technician shook his head. We've lost main feed from his helmet cam, but we still have the bird's eye of the base from the NRO sat. The young man indicated another monitor. It showed a black and white overshot to Fort Dietrich, centered on a courtyard of buildings. Painter paced before the array of monitors. It had all been a trap, one directed at Sigma and aimed at him personally. Alert Fort Dietrich security. Sir? The question rose from his second in command, Logan Gregory. Painter understood Logan's hesitation. Only a handful of those in power knew of Sigma and the agents it employed. The president, the joint chiefs, and his immediate supervisors over at DARPA. After last year's shake-up among the top brass, the organization was under intense scrutiny. Mistakes would not be tolerated. I won't risk an agent, Painter said. Call them in. Yes, sir. Logan crossed to a phone. The man appeared more a California surfer than a leading strategist. Blonde hair, tanned, fit but going a bit soft in the belly. Painter was his darker shadow, half Native American, black hair, blue eyes. But he had no tan. He didn't know the last time he had seen the sun. Painter wanted to sit down, lower his head to his knees. He had assumed control of the organization only 8 months ago, and most of that time had been spent restructuring and shoring up security after the infiltration of the group by an international cartel known as the Guild. There had been no telling what information had been gleaned, sold, or spread during this time, so everything had to be purged and rebuilt from scratch. Even their central command had been pulled out of Arlington and moved to a subterranean warren here in Washington. In fact, Painter had come in early this morning to unpack boxes in his new office when he had received the emergency call from Satellite Recon. He studied the monitor from the NRO satellite. A trap. He knew what the Guild was doing. 4 weeks ago, Painter had begun to put operatives into the field again. The first in more than a year. It was a tentative test. 2 teams, one over in Los Alamos investigating the loss of a nuclear database, and the other in his own backyard, over at Fort Dietrich, only 1 hour from Washington. The Guild's attack sought to shake Sigma and its leader, to prove that the Guild still had knowledge to undermine Sigma. It was a feint to force Sigma to pull back again, to regroup, possibly to disband. As long as Painter's group was out of commission, the Guild had a greater chance to operate with impunity. That must not happen. Painter stopped his pacing and turned to his second, the question plain on his face. I keep getting cut off, Logan said, nodding to the earpiece. They're having intermittent communication blackouts throughout the base. Certainly the handiwork of the Guild, too. Frustrated, Painter leaned on the console and stared at the mission's dossier. Imprinted atop the manila file was a single Greek letter. Sigma. In mathematics, the letter sigma represented the sum of all parts, the unification of disparate sets into a whole. It was also emblematic of the organization Painter directed, Sigma Force. Operating under the auspices of DARPA, the Department of Defense's Research and Development Wing,
Sigma served as the agency's covert arm out in the world, sent forth to safeguard, acquire, or neutralize technologies vital to U.S. security. Its team members were an ultra-secret cadre of ex-Special Forces soldiers who had been handpicked and placed into rigorous fast-track doctoral programs, covering a wide range of scientific disciplines, forming a militarized team of technically trained operatives, or in plainer language, killer scientists. Painter opened the dossier before him. The team leader's file fronted the record. Doctor and Commander Grayson Pierce. The agent's photograph stared up at him from the upper right corner. It was the man's mugshot from his year of incarceration at Leavenworth. Dark hair shaved to a stubble, blue eyes still angry. His Welsh heritage was evident in the sharp cheekbones, wide eyes, and strong jaw. But his ruddy complexion was all Texan, burnt by the sun over the dry hills of Brown County. Painter didn't bother glancing over the inch-thick file. He knew the details. Gray Pierce had joined the Army at 18, the Rangers at 21, and served to distinction off and on the field. Then, at 23, he was court-martialed for striking a superior officer. Painter knew the details and the back history of the two in Bosnia, and considering the events, Painter might have done the same. Still, rules were codified in granite among the armed forces. The decorated soldier spent 1 year in Leavenworth. But Gray Pierce was too valuable to be cast aside forever. His training and skill could not be wasted. Sigma had recruited him 3 years ago, right out of prison. Now Gray was a pawn between the Guild and Sigma, one about to be crushed. "I've got base security," Logan said, relief ringing in his voice. "Get them over." "Sir!" The technician leapt to his feet, still tethered to his console by the headset's cord. He glanced to Painter. "Director Crow, I'm picking up a trace audio feed." "What?" Painter stepped closer to the technician. He raised a hand to hold off Logan. The technician turned up the feed on the speakers. A tinny voice reached them, though the video feed remained fritzed. One word formed. "Goddamn motherfucking piece of shit!" 5:07 a.m., Frederick, Maryland. Gray kicked out a heel, catching the woman in the midriff. He felt a satisfying thud of flesh, but heard nothing. His ears rang from the concussion of the slug against his Kevlar helmet. The shot had spiderwebbed his face shield. His left ear burned as the electronic bay shorted with a burst of static. He ignored it all. Rolling to his feet, he slipped the carbonized dagger from its wrist sheath and dove under a neighboring row of tables. Another shot, sounding like a loud cough, penetrated the ring of his ears. Wood splintered from the edge of the table. He cleared the far side and kept a wary crouch while searching the room. His kick had caused the woman to drop her flashlight, which rolled on the floor, skittering shadows everywhere. He fingered his chest. The body blow of the assassin's first shot still burned and ached, but no blood. The woman called to him from the shadows. "Liquid body armor." Gray dropped lower, attempting to pinpoint the woman's location. The dive under the table had jarred his helmet's internal heads-up display. Its holographic images flickered incoherently across the inside of his face shield, interfering with his sight lines, but he dared not abandon the helmet. It offered the best protection against the weapon still in the woman's hand. That and his bodysuit. The assassin was right. Liquid body armor. Developed by U.S. Army Research Laboratory in 2003, the fabric of his bodysuit had been soaked with a sheer thickening fluid, hard microparticles of silica suspended in a polyethylene glycol solution. During normal movement, it acted like a liquid, but once a bullet struck, the material solidified into a rigid shield, preventing penetration. The suit had just saved his life. At least for now. The woman spoke again, coldly calm, as she slowly circled toward the door. "I rigged the building with C4 and TNT.
Easy enough, since the structure is already scheduled for demolition. The army was nice enough to have it all pre-wired. It just took a minor detonator modification to change the building's implosion to one that will cause an explosive updraft. Gray pictured the resulting plume of smoke and debris riding high into the early morning sky. "The vials of anthrax," he mumbled, but it was loud enough to be heard. It seemed fitting to use the base's own demolition as a toxic delivery system. Christ! She had turned the entire building into a biological bomb. With the strong winds, it was not only the base at risk, but the entire town of nearby Frederick. Gray moved. She had to be stopped. But where was she? He edged toward the door himself now, wary of her gun, but he couldn't let that stop him. Too much was at stake. He tried flicking on his night vision mode, but all he earned was another snap of flame by his ear. The heads-up display continued its erratic flashing, dazzling and confusing to the eye. Screw it. He thumbed the catch and yanked the helmet off. The fresh wash of air smelled moldy and antiseptic at the same time. Staying low, he carried the helmet in one hand, the dagger in the other. He reached the back wall and hurried toward the door. He could see well enough to tell the swinging door hadn't moved. The assassin was still in the room. But where? And what could he do to stop her? He squeezed the handle of his knife, gun against dagger. Not good odds. With his helmet off, he spotted a shift of shadows near the door. He stopped, going dead still. She was crouched 3 feet from the door, shielded by a table. Watery light filtered from the hallway, glowing through the windows of the swinging doors. Dawn neared, brightening the passage beyond. The assassin would have to expose herself to make her escape. For the moment, she clung to the shadows of the windowless lab, unsure if her opponent was armed or not. Gray had to stop playing this Dragon Lady's game. With a roundhouse swing, he threw his helmet toward the opposite side of the lab. It landed with a crash and tinkle of glass, shattering one of the old tanks. He ran toward her position. He only had seconds. She popped from her hiding place, swiveling to lay down fire in the direction of the noise. At the same time, she leaped gracefully toward the door, seeming to use the recoil from her gun to propel her. Gray could not help but be impressed, but not enough to slow him. With his arm already cocked, he whipped his dagger through the air. Weighted and balanced to perfection, the carbonized blade flew with unerring accuracy. It struck the woman square in the hollow of her throat. Gray continued his headlong rush. Only then did he realize his mistake. The dagger bounced harmlessly away and clattered to the floor. Liquid body armor. No wonder the Dragon Lady knew about his bodysuit. She was wearing the same. The attack, though, threw off her leap. She landed in a half crash, plainly turning a knee. But, ever the skilled assassin, she never lost sight of her target. From a step away, she aimed the Sig Sauer at Gray's face. And this time, he had no helmet.
"5:09 a.m., Washington, D.C. "We've lost all contact again," the technician said needlessly. Painter had heard the loud crash a moment before. Then all went deadly silent on the satellite feed. "I still have base security," his second said by the phone. Painter tried to piece together the cacophony he had heard over the line. He tossed his helmet. The other two men stared at him. Painter studied the open dossier in front of him. Grayson Pierce was no fool. Besides his military expertise, the man had first come to Sigma's attention because of his aptitude and intelligence tests. He was certainly above the norm, well above. But there were soldiers with even higher scores. What had been the final factor in the decision to recruit him had been his odd behavior while incarcerated at Leavenworth. Despite the hard labor of the camp, Grayson had taken up a rigorous regimen of study in both advanced chemistry and Taoism. This disparity in his choice of study had intrigued Painter and Sigma's former director, Dr. Sean McKnight.
In many ways, he proved to be a walking contradiction. A Welshman living in Texas, a student of Taoism who still carried a rosary, a soldier who studied chemistry in prison. It was this very uniqueness of his mind that had won him membership into Sigma. But such distinctiveness came with a price. Grayson Pierce did not play well with others. He had a profound distaste for working with a team. Like now, going in alone, against protocol.
Sir?
His second persisted. Painter took a deep breath. 2 more minutes. 5:10 a.m., Frederick, Maryland. The first shot whistled past his ear. Gray was lucky. The assassin had shot too fast, before being properly set. Gray, still in motion from his lunge, just managed to duck out of the way. A head shot was not as easy as the movies made it seem. He tackled the woman and pinned her gun between them. Even if she fired, he would still have a good chance of surviving. Only it would hurt like hell. She fired, proving this last point. The slug slammed into his left thigh. It felt like a hammer blow, bruising to the marrow. He screamed, and why the hell not? It stung like a motherfucker, but he didn't let go. He used his anger to slam an elbow into her throat, but her body armor stiffened, protecting her. Damn it! She pulled the trigger again. He outweighed her, outmuscled her, but she didn't need the strength of fist and knee. She had the might of modern artillery at her disposal. The slug sucker-punched into his gut, pounded all the way to his spine. His breath blew out of him. She was slowly maneuvering her gun upward. The Sig Sauer had a 15-round magazine. How many shots had she fired? Surely she still had enough to pound him into a pulp. He needed to end this. He lifted his head back and slammed his forehead into her face. But she was no novice to brawling. She turned her head, taking the blow to the side of her skull. Still, it bought him enough time to kick out at a cord trailing from the nearby table. The library lamp attached to it came crashing to the floor, its green glass shade shattered. Bear-hugging the woman, he rolled her over the lamp. It was too much to hope that the glass would penetrate her bodysuit, but that wasn't his goal. He heard the pop of the lamp's bulb under their combined weight. Good enough. Frogging his legs under him, Gray leaped outward. It was a gamble. He flew toward the light switch beside the swinging door. A cough of a pistol accompanied a slam into his lower back. His neck whiplashed. His body struck the wall. As he bounded off, his hand palmed the electrical box and flipped the switch. Lights flickered across the lab, unsteady. Bad wiring. He fell back toward the assassin. He couldn't hope to electrocute his nemesis. That only happened in the movies, too. That wasn't his goal. Instead, he hoped whoever had last used the desk had left the lamp switched on. Keeping his feet, he pivoted around. The dragon lady sat atop the broken lamp, arm outstretched toward him, gun pointing. She pulled the trigger, but her aim was off. One of the windows in the swinging door shattered. Gray stepped around to the side, moving further out of range. The woman could not track him. She was frozen rigidly in place, unable to move. "Liquid body armor," he said, repeating her earlier words. "The liquid does make for a flexible suit, but it also has a disadvantage." He stalked up to her side and relieved her of her gun. "Propylene glycol is an alcohol, a good conductor of electricity. Even a small charge, like from a broken light bulb, will flow over a suit in seconds. And as with any assault, the suit reacts." He kicked her in the shin. The suit was as hard as a rock. "Goes rigid on you." Her own suit had become her prison. He searched her rapidly as she strained to move. With effort, she could make slow progress, but no more than the rusted tin man from The Wizard of Oz. She gave up. Her face reddened from her strain. "You won't find any detonator. It's all on a timer, set for..." Her eyes glanced down to a wristwatch. 2 minutes from now, you'll never deactivate all the charges.
Gray noted the number on her watch drop below 2 minutes. Her life was tied to that number, too. He saw the flicker of fear in her eyes. Assassin or not, she was still human, afraid of her own mortality. But the rest of her face only hardened to match her rigid suit. "Where did you stash the vials?" He knew she wouldn't tell him, but he watched her eyes. For a moment, the pupils shifted slightly up, then centered on him. The roof. It made sense. He needed no other confirmation. Anthrax, Bacillus anthracis, was sensitive to heat. If she wanted the bloom of toxic spores to spread outward from the blast, the vials would have to be up high, caught in the initial concussive blast and jettisoned skyward. She couldn't risk the heat of the explosion incinerating the weaponized bacterium. Before he could move, she spat at him, hitting him on the cheek. He didn't bother wiping it off. He didn't have the time. 1:48. He straightened and ran for the door. "You'll never make it," she called after him. Somehow she knew he was going for the biobomb, not fleeing for his own life. And for some reason that pissed him off, like she knew him well enough to make that assumption. He ran down the outer corridor and skidded into the stairwell. He pounded up the 2 flights to reach the roof door. The exit had been modified to meet OSHA standards. A panic bar gated the door, made for quick evacuation in case of a fire. Panic pretty much defined this moment. He struck the bar, initiating an alarm klaxon, and pushed out into the dark gray of early dawn. The roof was tar and paper. Sand crunched underfoot. He scanned the area. There were too many places to hide the vials, air vents, exhaust pipes, satellite dishes. Where? He was running out of time. 5:13 a.m., Washington, D.C. "He's on the roof," the technician said, jabbing a finger at the monitor from the NRO satellite. Painter leaned closer and spotted a tiny figure stepping into view. What was Grayson doing on the roof? Painter searched the immediate area. "Any sign of pursuit?"
"None that I can detect, sir."
Logan spoke from the phone.
"Base security reports a fire alarm going off in Building 470.
"Must have tripped the exit alarm," the tech interjected.
"Can you get us any closer?" Painter asked.
The technician nodded and toggled a switch. The image zoomed down atop Grayson Pierce. His helmet was gone. His left ear appeared stained bloody. He continued to stand by the doorway. "What is he doing?" the tech asked.
"Base security is responding," Logan reported.
Painter shook his head, but a cold certainty iced through him.
"Tell base security to stay away. Have them evacuate anyone near that building."
"Sir?"
"Do it."
5:14 a.m., Frederick, Maryland. Gray scanned the roof one more time. The emergency klaxon continued to wail. He ignored it, drawing inward. He had to think like his quarry. He crouched low. It had rained last night. He imagined the woman had only planted the vials recently, after the downpour. He looked carefully and noted where the sand, washed smooth by the rain, had been disturbed. It wasn't too difficult, as he knew she had to have passed through this door. It was the only roof access. He trailed her steps. They led across the roof to a hooded exhaust vent. Of course. The exhaust flume would serve as the perfect chimney to expel the spores as the lower levels of the building imploded, creating a toxic blowgun. Kneeling, he spotted where she had tampered with the hood, disturbing an old layer of rust. He didn't have the time to check for booby traps. He yanked the vent off with a grunt. The bomb rested inside the duct. The 15 glass vials were arrayed in a starburst around a central pellet of C4. Just enough to shatter the containers. He stared at the white powder filling each tube. Biting his lower lip, he reached down and carefully lifted the bomb out of the duct's throat. A timer counted down. 54. 53. 52. Free of the ductwork, Gray straightened. He did a fast check of the bomb.
It was rigged against tampering. He had no time to decipher the wires and electronics. The bomb was going to go off. He had to get it away from the building, away from the blast zone, preferably away from him. 41. Only one chance. He tucked the bomb into a nylon ditty pouch over one shoulder and stalked to the front of the building. Headlights aimed toward the building, drawn by the alarm. Base security would never reach here in time. He had no choice. He had to get clear, no matter his own life. Retreating several steps from roof's edge, he took a deep breath, then sprinted back toward the front of the building. Reaching the roof's edge, he bounded up and leaped over the brick parapet. He sailed out over the 6-story drop. 5:15 a.m., Washington, D.C.
"Christ almighty!"
Logan exclaimed as Grayson made the leap off the roof.
"He's numbnuts crazy,"
the tech appended, jerking to his feet. Painter simply watched the man's suicidal ploy. He's doing what he must. 5:15 a.m., Frederick, Maryland. Gray kept his legs under him, arms out for balance. He plummeted earthward. He prayed the laws of physics, velocity, trajectory, and vector analysis didn't betray him. He readied for the impact. 2 stories below and 20 yards out, the spherical roof of the 8-ball rose up to meet him. The million-liter steel containment globe glistened with morning dew. He twisted in midair, struggling to keep his plunge feet first. Then time sped up, or he did. His booted feet hit the surface of the sphere. The liquid body armor cemented around his ankles, protecting against a break. Momentum slammed him forward, face down, spread-eagled. But he had not reached the center of the sphere's roof, only the curved shell closest to Building 470. Fingers scrabbled, but there was no grip, no traction. His body slid down the dew-slick steel, twisting slightly askew. He spread his legs, toes dragging for friction. Then he was past the point of no return, free-falling down the sheer side. With his cheek pressed to the steel, he didn't see the catwalk until he struck it. His left leg hit, then his body tumbled after it. He landed on hands and knees atop the metal scaffolding that had been built around the equator of the steel globe. He shoved to his feet, legs wobbling from the strain and the terror. He couldn't believe he was still alive. He searched the curve of the sphere while freeing the biobomb from his ditty bag. The surface of the containment globe was pocked with portholes, once used by scientists to observe their biological experiments inside. In all the years of its regular use, no pathogen had ever escaped. Gray prayed the same held true this morning. He glanced to the bomb in his hand. 18 seconds. With no time to curse, he ran along the exterior catwalk, searching for an entry hatch. He found it half a hemisphere away. A steel door with a porthole. He sprinted to it, grabbed the handle, and tugged. It refused to budge. Locked.
This ends Disc 1.